welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, October 9, 2023. The new mayor of Juba City calls for transparency in service delivery to the residents of the town.
I will serve entirely. I am going to be committed and I am not going to work against anybody. I will start from where the former mayor has left and we work together. I want to tell you, local government officials and executives.
And the UN Refugee Agency says donor fatigue is threatening the lives of people fleeing conflict, persecution, human rights violation, climate change, and oppressive poverty.
Political instability, violence perpetrated by armed groups is forcing more people to flee, including to coastal states. Or in Somalia, where the climate emergency coupled with conflict has forced nearly 900,000 people from their homes.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The French medical charity Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French acronym MSF, says cases of malaria and malnutrition is increasing among the South Sudanese returning to Upper Nile from Sudan's conflict. MSF head of mission in South Sudan says around 290,000 individuals who entered South Sudan through Reng face limited access to food, shelter, water, sanitation and health care. For VOA News, Dengai Deng has details from Juba.
Mary Nyakume is a South Sudanese returnee from Sudan. She says there is no food, mosquito nets and other basic items for her family members. She says her children have been exposed to malaria and other diseases.
I came to South Sudan because of the war in Sudan. My husband and my sister were killed in Khartoum, and I fled with their children. They are all here with me. Taking care of them has really become difficult because there is no food, shelter, and medicine.
Abid Dao Alak is a clinical officer with the MSF in Reng. Alak says many returnees, especially children, who are arriving from Sudan to Reng are suffering from deadly diseases like measles, malaria, and malnutrition.
The situation of the patient I'm seeing here is that most of them had malaria, 70% of them. Others had malnutrition for children under 5, pregnant and lactating mothers. And the other one is that they have lower respiratory tract infection, diarrhea and eye infection. These are the main morbidities that we are treating in the three camps.
Alak said health centers in Reng are recording a 70% rate of malaria, a disease that he says has already killed more people. George Lin Yapi is the MSF head of mission in South Sudan. He says aid agencies are trying their best to respond to the needs of the returnees.
We are calling on humanitarian and medical groups to do more by strengthening activities at the entry point and at tracing centers. Basic healthcare services should be available at all time on the border for those coming with medical conditions. A systematic vaccination catch-up should also be available 24/7 on the border, given the current low vaccination coverage in Sudan and ongoing outbreak of measles in both countries.
Yapi says malnutrition cases have increased in Reng. He says more therapeutic feeding centers could avert cases of malnutrition in the area.
Malnourished children in particular must be given urgent nutritional support at the border and be transferred to medical facilities at once. Relief items such as mosquito net, plastic sheet, and other essential items should also be provided at the border so nobody who is in need is missed out.
Since the fighting erupted in Sudan 6 months ago, around 290,000 individuals have entered South Sudan through the Jorda border in Upper Nile State. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Juba.
In opening UNHCR's annual refugee conference, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees warned aid fatigue is growing at a time when a record number of people are fleeing conflict, persecution, human rights violations, climate change, and grinding poverty. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says the Hamas attacks against Israeli civilians and Israel's response in the past few days will cause more suffering for civilians on both sides and increase instability in the region. He describes the violence as another dangerous piece in a growing mosaic of crises. At the start of the UNHCR refugee conference Monday, he noted it is mainly conflict that is driven forced displacement to a record 110 million people, the highest in decades. As conflicts grow, he warns, so does disrespect for international humanitarian law. During a visit to Egypt, South Sudan, and Chad this summer, he says he met refugees fleeing the devastating conflict in Sudan who spoke of the destruction, death, torture, and rape they left behind.
They recounted how they had to run from the brutal violence that erupted without warning on the 15th of April. Their lives upended as suddenly as were those of the Ukrainians the year before and of many Ukrainians now facing every day the death and destruction resulting from the Russian invasion.
Grandi says these stories are those of all 110 million people around the world who have been forced from their homes by conflict, violence, and persecution. He says the global situation is dire and getting worse. Noting the UNHCR responded to 44 new emergencies in 31 countries over the past year. The latest emergency, he says, saw 100,000 refugees fleeing the Azerbaijan enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh for safety to Armenia. He notes violence continues in many places, such as in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where nearly 1.5 million people have been displaced this year alone.
Or in Central Sahel, where amidst growing political instability, violence perpetrated by armed groups is forcing more people to flee, including to coastal states. Or in Somalia, where the climate emergency coupled with conflict has forced nearly 900,000 people from their homes.
The High Commissioner says he's extremely worried that underfunding hampers UNHCR's operations. For example, he notes the $1 billion plan to help refugees from Sudan was just 25% funded. He adds this is only one of many humanitarian operations that are short of cash this year, and we're forced to make drastic cuts in food rations, protection needs, and other services. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to South Sudan's capital, Juba, where some women have welcomed the appointment of the first female mayor for the city. Some of the women who spoke to VOA say they believe the new mayor has the capacity to clean the city and restore order. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
The governor of Central Equatorial State, Emmanuel Adil Anthony, appointed Flora Gabriel Modi as Juba City's first female mayor and three deputies over the weekend. Juba resident Irene Ayar says South Sudanese women can perform better at various government institutions if given a chance. Aya says she looks forward to seeing the mayor prioritize garbage collections and rehabilitation of roads within residential areas.
I know women are always very keen in terms of making sure that everything is done like neatly in a right way. Juba City in general has really been very dirty in terms of garbage. I expect that she will really do a lot of things to clean Juba, to make Juba to look like really a real city. And I expect also she will be concerned about the road in Juba. She will do something about the road.
Doru Penina, another Juba resident, says she expects the mayor to be confident and authoritative while performing her duties in the city.
While giving her speeches, she should be able to present women. She should be audible so that the people can see the ability of a woman. Because I have still this traditional beliefs that women are not confident, which is not true. We have women outside there who are really having sound mind, but it's only that we are underrated.
Addressing Juba municipal employees during her reception on Monday, Mayor Flora Gabriel Modi says she will work together with members of the Juba City Council to deliver services to the people of the city. She says she will start her work from where the former mayor stopped.
I will serve entirely. I am going to be committed and I am not going to work against anybody. I will start from where the former mayor has left and we work together. I want to tell you, local government officials and executives and all the structures here, we want to work with transparency because we are servants of this city.
Aya says she expects the newly appointed mayor and her deputies to address the issues of vendors encroaching roadsides along the streets of Juba.
I know how hard it is, but I'm sure that she's also going to deal with that and make sure women get decent places for doing businesses than on the road, because along the road it also causes a lot of traffic. Sometimes, you know, most of this traffic, especially around evening hours, are caused because there are people selling along the road.
Modi urges her city council team to ensure the city is clean, adding that Juba is the capital and the face of South Sudan. Governor Emmanuel Adil removed acting mayor Emmanuel Khamis Richard last month following a public outcry and demands for his dismissal. Khamis' dismissal came after a widely circulated video on social media showing him armed with a pistol striking a female street vendor in South Sudan capital Juba. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what provoked the renewed clashes between Hamas and Israel? Stay tuned for an answer after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The dead toll in the Hamas incursion into Israel has risen to 600, the largest single-day death toll in Israeli history. At least 300 Palestinians have died in retaliatory Israeli airstrikes. The South African government says it's not surprised by the scale of the conflict that has erupted in Israel and Gaza. Palestinian militants from Hamas organization entered Israel on Saturday, killing and abducting hundreds of citizens and soldiers. Israel has responded by declaring war on Hamas and has retaliated with deadly airstrikes on what it calls terrorist targets in Gaza. Hundreds of people have died on both sides of the border. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's diplomatic relations with Israel are strained because the African National Congress government calls it an apartheid state. The ANC says Tel Aviv treats Palestinians the way the apartheid government oppressed black South Africans, segregating and impoverishing them based on the Palestinians' ethnicity. Pretoria accuses Israel of illegally occupying parts of the West Bank, the larger of the two Palestinian territories. The other is the Gaza Strip, one of the world's most densely populated and poorest regions. South Africa provides both material and public support to what the ANC calls Palestine's Liberation Cause. Pretoria has an embassy in Tel Aviv and a well-staffed office in Ramallah on the West Bank. Director General of South Africa's Department of International Relations, Zane Dangor, tells VOA his representatives in Ramallah reported frustration among Palestinians leading up to Saturday's attacks by Hamas.
The breaches of international law by the Israeli government has escalated to the extent that many of us were not surprised by the events. It's regrettable. We think that nobody benefits from an escalation of violence and conflict, but we did see this coming given the number of killings of civilians over the last 12 months or so. South Africa's position is always that war is never an option. War is never wise. But we also believe that once the use of force is engaged in by any of these forces, whether it's the occupying forces or even those fighting what can be called wars of resistance, that the Geneva Conventions must be respected. All of them must ensure that civilians and non-combatants are not attacked.
After a vote in Parliament earlier this year, South Africa downgraded the status of its embassy and diplomatic mission in Tel Aviv. South Africa's large Jewish community, like others around the world, has reacted with outrage to the Hamas attack. Howard Saxteen, editor of the South African Jewish Report, spoke to VOA.
This will result in putting back the peace process a generation, maybe two generations. 700 Jews are dead in a single day. And there is no calling at this point in time for ceasefires or moving on. The people of Israel have been massacred.
Dangor, an international law expert, says his government is available to be part of any process aimed at securing an immediate ceasefire between Israeli and Palestinian forces.
We've been engaging with the Palestinian Authority, not with anybody else at this stage, but we are open to engaging with any of the players so that we can actually assist in whatever way we can towards a just and lasting peace and the negotiations that need to precede that.
Dangor says the United Nations must be at the center of efforts to secure this just and lasting peace. But the South African government position is that this is only possible if Israel withdraws its forces from Palestinian territory and stops allowing Jewish settlements on the West Bank. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
In recent years, UNICEF and UNESCO reports have emphasized that female teachers are making a big difference when it comes to educating girls across Africa. VOA visited Lusaka, Zambia to see the impact they are having there. Cut it short, reports.
So when we are talking about children...
Josephine Mwaba has been a teacher for 22 years. She teaches biology at Lusaka's Kablonga Girls Secondary School. Mwaba says her students love learning, but the young girls here face challenges.
So the challenges are that girls fall pregnant, and sometimes they get married at an early stage. But being a female teacher, I encourage them not to get married early, not to fall pregnant, but to concentrate on school. Because only when they get educated, then they'll be able to make proper decisions and live an independent life.
Rebecca Kaira is a student at the school, one of the many taught by female teachers like Mwaba.
Female teachers mostly encourage us girls because they act as mothers as we're here at school. So they mostly encourage us girls to focus on education.
According to Zambia's Teaching Service Commission, or TSC, there are more than 190,000 teachers in the country, but at least 150,000 more are needed to ensure quality and effective education. The TSC is a government body in charge of human resources, policy guidance, accreditation and validation of teachers' qualifications. Sonakshi Sharma, an education research specialist at UNICEF Innocenti Global Office of Research and Foresight, works on the organization's Women in Learning Leadership Research. Sharma says evidence shows that for girls, female teachers play a positive role in learning.
So school leadership is an important vector to enhance student learning because they play a critical role in creating a high-quality teaching and learning environment within schools, and this can contribute to overall student learning outcomes and well-being.
The Basic Education Teachers Union of Zambia, which represents teachers in the public service in the country, says female teachers are driving forces in Zambia's education system. One of the country's biggest challenges challenges is serving students in rural areas. Another is paying teachers what they deserve, says Mwangala Mulako, the union's director of gender-related issues.
We have more of women presentation in our union than the male. And then these teachers, most of them, the women that we have, they have upgraded themselves. What I mean is they've furthered in their studies from maybe a certificate holder to a diploma holder or a degree holder, even as far as masters in different fields of education. So the situation which is there is they are all crying for an upgrade. They need to be moved from the lower salary scales to higher salary scales.
According to UNICEF, African countries, including Zambia, are facing the world's worst teacher shortage. The continent still needs 17 million more teachers if it is to achieve universal primary and secondary education by 2030, and more female teachers are needed now more than ever. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
In late July, Ghana's parliament voted to make it a crime to accuse a person of witchcraft. If the president signs the bill into law, it will also force the closure of camps where hundreds of accused witches live in exile. Hamza Adams has the report, narrated by Grace Oyenubi.
Every morning, Fatima comes to this camp to help her mother with chores. Her mother has lived here for 5 years, forced to flee her home after being accused of witchcraft. Fatima, who also goes by her first name, says her mother was accused of witchcraft in a part of northern Ghana where traditional beliefs are deeply rooted. But Fatima says her mother can't go back to her community because the stigma attached to such labels is hard to shake off.
It's been 5 years since traditional healers in this camp declared that my mother was not a witch. We want to take her home, but the community is unwilling to accept her. That is the reason why I came here to take care of her.
More than 500 people are living in this camp because they have been accused of witchcraft. Nearly 67% of people in the country accused of witchcraft are widows, according to a 2022 report by Songtaba, a human rights organization and susceptible to violence. In 2020, a 90-year-old woman was beaten to death in Kafaba, in Ghana's Savannah region, over a witchcraft accusation. Amnesty International's Genevieve Partington says such attacks are not acceptable.
People feel if they accuse someone of being a witch, they can lynch them, beat them, you know, let them, submit them to all sorts of human rights abuses, and it's not right.
In July, Ghana's parliament passed a bill criminalizing the accusation of witchcraft, but the bill is still waiting for President Nana Akufo-Addo's signature. If implemented, the bill will also force the closure of camps housing accused witches across the country. Francis Kevia Sosu is a parliamentarian who moved for the passage of the bill.
At the UN level, the Human Rights Council and the periodic reviews of Ghana always made reference to issues of witchcraft and women who are left in witch camps and violated all the universal declarations on human rights.
Human rights groups in Ghana have lauded Parliament's efforts, and Amnesty's Partington says the bill also carries penalties for people who make accusations of witchcraft.
If you abuse physically, emotionally, any person or accuse them of witchcraft, you can go to jail for a period of up to 5 years. I think this is something very important.
In 2014, Ghana's government attempted to close the 6 witch camps in the country, but managed to shut down only one. Analysts hope passing the bill and closing the remaining 5 camps will end the exile and suffering of the hundreds of women accused of witchcraft. For Hamza Adam in Kumasi, Ghana, Grace Oyenubi, VOA News.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday, October 9th. We now leave you with Ali Akiba and the song Dodo.
Yeah.
Sipendani vitendo, si maneno maneno. Yonakupa kitengo, kwa kufika malengo. Umeziba mapengo, kwa upendo upendo. Ebwana wana zingo, anzeni vikao vya sendo. Yeah. Mana, remrembo na kujuza. Mama, na shukuru umekuza. Chana, chema pete na kutunza. Anamba, moja ute waburuza. Na umesha isima, na yo 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 yo. Mama yo, mama yo.
You've been listening to Alia Kiba and the song Dodo. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Adrius Regis, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mana, nashukuru umekuza. Chanda, chema pete na kutunza. Namba, koja ote waburuza. Na umesha nizima.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the second Monday of October, many in the United States commemorate the voyage of discovery by Europeans to the Americas and the man who led it, Christopher Columbus. On October 12, 1492, the three ships under his command landed in today's Bahamas archipelago and claimed the land for Spain. The purpose of the voyage was to find a shorter, safer route to the Far East, thus eliminating the long trip around Africa. Such a shortcut would be of immense economic value to the Spanish crown, which financed what proved to be the most daring and momentous voyage in history. But although he undertook his voyage on behalf of Spain, Columbus himself was an Italian navigator from Genoa, and for that reason, Columbus Day came to be recognized as a celebration of people of Italian descent and their accomplishments. But not everyone was happy to celebrate Columbus and his voyage of discovery, as it was quickly followed by an influx of European conquerors and colonizers that spelled disaster for the native populations. Columbus, his men, and many of those who followed in their footsteps were brutal to the local populations, enslaving and exploiting them and unknowingly infecting them with European diseases for which they had no immunity. That pattern repeated itself elsewhere as Europeans settled in the Americas. So, while today many people, particularly those of Italian descent, celebrate Columbus Day on that second Monday in October, 26 states and numerous cities and organizations around the country hold a counter-celebration, Indigenous Peoples Day. This dichotomy reaches all the way to the White House. Last year, President Joe Biden issued two holiday proclamations. The first one was for Columbus Day, in which he noted that Columbus's voyage inspired many others to follow and ultimately contributed to the founding of America, which has been a beacon for immigrants across the world. The second stated that on Indigenous Peoples Day, we honor the sovereignty, resilience, and immense contributions that Native Americans have made to the world. On Indigenous Peoples Day, we recognize that some of those who call themselves Americans are descendants of people who have lived on this continent for thousands of years. Others have come or are descended from those who came from many cultures and from all around the world, seeking a better life. And all of them contributed to who we are today.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.